I realized that I was lashing out in anger at times. And really, it was just because I felt so out of control over what was going on with my dad's health, how to quote unquote save him. And it was real grief that I was feeling.
What happens when an entire generation is thrust into a caregiving role that they never saw coming, at a time when they're supposed to be building their own lives and barely anyone is talking about it? Why do people feel so alone when there are actually so many others in a similar situation? Jennifer Levin was 32, living in Los Angeles, celebrating her first TV writing credit in her first apartment without a roommate. Then her father fell, and fell again. What started as small worrying signs, a stumble here, a cognitive slip there, became a life-changing PSP diagnosis. All of a sudden, Jennifer found herself managing medical appointments from across the country, becoming a healthcare proxy, coordinating care, all while trying to maintain her budding career in television. She felt completely isolated, like she was the only young person dealing with anything like this. Then she discovered a staggering statistic. Over 10 million millennials were already caregiving for family members, one in four people her age.
And so I thought, if one out of four people are a millennial who has taken on some form of caregiving, I know more than four people. Statistically, I know other people going through this. So why am I not talking about it? Why is nobody else talking about it? Why isn't this a bigger thing that's in the discussion?
The answer she found reveals something profound about care in America. We're living through an invisible crisis that even the people directly affected have barely acknowledged, and it starts with how we view ourselves. We're providing $600 billion worth of unpaid care annually, reshaping careers, relationships, and life plans around responsibilities that people never expected to carry this young. Jennifer joined me to talk about her book, Generation Care: The New Culture of Caregiving, a deeply personal yet universal account of what happens when someone becomes a care partner decades earlier than expected. We explore how this hidden crisis is reshaping an entire generation's lives and why we urgently need to change how we talk about caregiving. What emerges is both sobering and hopeful. While the structural challenges are immense, the millennial response reveals that deep-seated love is at the heart of the generation's values. Despite feeling isolated and overwhelmed, this generation continues to show up for their loved ones, because when it matters most, showing up is non-negotiable. Their community-driven approach to caregiving, Jennifer argues, could transform care into something more transparent, connected, and sustainable. If you want to just tell me a little bit about your background and your journey.
Sure. So my name is Jennifer Levin, and I was living in Los Angeles. I'm a native New Yorker, and I had moved there after college to pursue a career in writing television. So I was working on a major drama at the time. I had just produced my first written by credit of television, just moved into my first apartment on my own without a roommate. And at that time is when my dad started displaying some symptoms in retrospect, but at the time they were little signs that seemed out of place for how he was normally. He was always incredibly healthy, never sick my whole life, completely independent, and was divorced. And I'm an only child living on his own. And then my mom and I both noticed these little cognitive things. And he started to fall a lot. That was worrisome just for obvious reasons. But the cumulative effect of it was that he went to go see a neurologist. And the neurologist at first diagnosed him with Parkinson's. And that seemed totally out of left field, but it also seemed like something that we had heard of. And that if you look at Michael J. Fox in the news, it was manageable. He had a career, you know, there was enough behind Parkinson's that you could figure out how to live with it well, or so it seemed. And then as he was taking medication for Parkinson's, it stopped working. And it was that reason that led him to a neurologist diagnosis of PSP, which we really had never heard of before. Just learning about it off the bat seemed frightening, frankly, that the diagnosis is like Parkinson's but worse. That wasn't something great to hear. And especially when you look at the fatality of it. So that was really something new for our family. And although my parents were divorced, my mom was very present in helping my dad at that time. So he began at first to live in an assisted living facility in the city. And that was pretty great, I think, because he was completely independent, could come and go as he pleased, had his own apartment within assisted living with our furniture, but still had a staff on hand that handled his medications, his doctor's appointments, kept everything moving. But then there was one time that I was in Los Angeles and my mom called me and she told me that my dad had fallen and was in the hospital. This was coming after a day of not being able to reach my dad on the phone, which was very unusual, calling him repeatedly, not getting an answer, calling the assisted living building and asking, "Have you seen him?" And they said he hadn't shown up at lunch, which was also unusual. So we asked them to enter his apartment to see if there was something wrong. So this entire experience in which there was this uncertainty of not knowing where he was and what had happened, even though he's in this supervised living environment. And then having had this pretty bad fall that put him in the hospital, thankfully he was okay, other than a message from the doctors that the PSP had progressed and the falls were now too common for him to be living as unsupervised as he was. And the assisted living facility said that he would need to move into a nursing home for 24/7 supervision. So that was when I was at this point about 32. And that's when everything changed. That's when I didn't know to consider myself a caregiver in that moment. But in retrospect, I would say that that's when things started shifting into a higher gear as far as what he needed, but also as far as the consumption in my mind of fear and stress around the disease.
So much of this book and just experiences we hear from people, they just have such a kind of whirlwind and disorienting kind of feeling to them. And one person in the book you quote is with a very relatable WTF is happening to me, basically. And what you just described kind of sounds like one of those moments.
I think particularly because I was so young that, chronic illness, thankfully, had not been something we had had to deal with in my family up until then. And also, geriatric care and PSP in general, all of these things were new to me. And so, it really is this like, what is going on experience, particularly even just wrapping my head around the fact that my dad was even undergoing this disease. That alone, I talk to people about it now, and I talk about kind of the shock that accompanies grief and my dad's passing and things like that. And I have a harder time wrapping my head around the fact that he ever got sick. That is still something I think I'm still trying to figure out how to process, even though it's been 10 years since he passed away.
Yeah, what is it about that? I know that, well, we can get into things like anticipatory grief and whatnot, but like, yeah, what does that feel like? Because for someone that has not experienced it, it's kind of hard to understand. Like, I feel like it's one of those things where you understand it if you understand it, type of thing.
You mean around the disease?
Just, yeah, like coping with the diagnosis.
I'd say it's asking you to accept a reality that you didn't anticipate and that you have a hard time reconciling with the person that you know, particularly with a disease like PSP. Having my dad, who is always so independent, like just known to walk the city for miles. I mean, just always on the go, to have then be diagnosed with a disease that deteriorates your muscles and robs you of some of that independence, it screws with your head a little bit. And one thing about my dad is that he's very resilient and strong and was not one to take no for an answer. So even as the disease progressed at its worst as he had it, he was still going into the gym at his nursing home every day, getting on the exercise bike, lifting weights. I mean, whatever his capacity was, he tried to push it every day. So if there's ever a day that I'm thinking, I'm too tired to work out, I don't feel like going to the gym, I think, come on, You can definitely do this. So that was a nice message for me. But at the same time, it is, you mentioned anticipatory loss, and it is various forms of grief to reconcile the person that you know and you've known your whole life with the person that they are today. And accepting that, trying to still work with it to see how can we keep you strong? How can we make sure you're not backsliding in your physical health, in your mental health? And, trying not to dwell on what could happen tomorrow.
Yeah, and so how did you go? Because obviously you've written this book, you are a founder of Caregiver Collective. How did you go from kind of managing this on your own to doing things like founding Caregiver Collective and writing this book?
I lived this as an only child who didn't have any friends at the time that had gone through something similar, let alone, not even with PSP, just with any sort of chronic illness, debilitating, aging related issue. No one I knew at that time had dealt with something like that. So, although close friends knew that I was, I don't think anybody knew quite the thing to say to me, although they tried their best. So, it was isolating, although I was surrounded by people. I had my mom that, really did a lot of this with me. But as far as having a peer and having someone who it's your parent, that was just on me at that time. And I remember feeling alone with it and in some ways probably retreating into myself a bit. And then it was after my father had passed away that I read the statistic of how many millennials were already caregiving for family. And at that time, it was over 10 million. And this is about 9 years ago. And I thought, okay, hang on. Over 10 million millennials, that was at the time about one out of four. And so I thought, if one out of four people are a millennial who has taken on some form of caregiving, I know more than four people. Statistically, I know other people going through this. So, why am I not talking about it? Why is nobody else talking about it? Why isn't this a bigger thing that's in the discussion? And why aren't we connecting with each other just for support and to share resources and to figure out how to do it? So, at that time, I decided to write an article because I'm a writer and I really wanted to shed light to a larger audience on how many millennials were caregiving and what that looked like, because I didn't know to call myself a caregiver until I read that statistic and that research, which really pointed out what caregiving entails. I was just being my dad's daughter. And so to now learn this caregiver title applies to me, there are peers of mine who are doing this, we should be talking about this. I wrote this piece for Cosmo, Cosmopolitan, because I wanted it to find people who, like me, were not expecting to read a story like this about themselves, possibly, and to relate to it through my story. And if you are living something similar to me, then you are also a caregiver, and we should be a bit more vocal about that and connect with each other. So I published this article, and at that same time, I launched Caregiver Collective on Facebook so that there would be a physical place in the internet, in which we could all meet, instead of that just being an idea that we have and is nice to connect with others. Well, here's where you go to do it. And it was pretty incredible because people joined, I mean, right away. And it was a bit of a slow process after a while. But I would say that the more I reached out to various groups and spoke more about it and wrote more about it, when people were aware of the group, they joined it. Because up until that time, there was no support group that was dedicated for caregivers that were our age dealing with anything. There were maybe a few local support groups, but nothing like this. And the fact that it could build awareness around the topic, but also build support, felt important to me. And through that, I began to see trends in how we were caregiving differently, how we were meeting the challenge differently at a younger age, but really, just how we were experiencing caregiving differently when you are younger in your employment history, younger in your financial history, and you don't have maybe money saved up. You don't have seniority at work to take time off if you're not granted some sort of family leave. How do you date when you're a caregiver? All these issues that are more topical for someone in their 20s, 30s, maybe early 40s, and not for somebody who's in their 70s, who's dealing with a more geriatric parent or aging spouse. So when I began to notice these trends, I began to poke into it a bit more to figure out why we're experiencing it this way. And through that is how I came to write a book about it.
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic because not only is it the millennial caregiving community, like it's a much bigger community than anyone realizes, but then also the experience itself is also like something people is just not very common. And the book, I think, does a really good job of like laying out this very like striking experience of having this expected life and then the reality of what you're going through and just keep up with everything and try to just stay sane. Could you just tell me a little bit about like what it feels like to have these like complicated emotions about like what you thought your life might be like? You might feel bad about feeling like that even, and then like the strength, like how do you keep going by default?
I think particularly dealing with this at a younger age, you're still in many ways identity building, and you are figuring out the career or the job track that's right for you. And particularly in the economy that we've grown up in, that you're able to get. And when you are maybe in a first job, maybe younger in your career, that might not be the last stop for you. And most likely in our generation, you're going to have other employers down the line. Maybe you decide after a few years, how many friends do I have that went to law school and became lawyers and then realized they hated it and then went to something totally different in which they could apply law to? You're still at that age when you're figuring that stuff out. You're still dating or young in a marriage, deciding whether you want to have children, deciding whether you can afford to buy a house. If you do, where will it be? If you can't, where will you live? Are you going to go to grad school? All of these questions, right, has you projecting into the future and what you want for yourself, while also giving yourself some leeway to divert paths as you're going. And so when you then add caregiving into this mix, that's a really big wrench that most likely you didn't see coming, particularly before you have the feeling of the pieces being in place in your life. So, right, how do you deal with this? Well, how you experience it is often with a sense of grief. And this is what I hear from a lot, if not all of the caregivers that I've interviewed, is this idea of I had this dream for my life, and now I have no idea if I'll ever be able to attain even one piece of it. I've always wanted to have children, but now how can I afford kids on top of caregiving costs? How can I afford the time to spend with children on top of what it caught on top of the, emotional output of caregiving. So people really having to wrestle with what they want. Are they able to have it now? Maybe is it something we table for later? And how do I feel about this? Dr. Lisa Paz, who I interview in the book, brings up this idea that just because you dreamt it would happen one way, doesn't mean if you actually got it, it would have gone the way that you expected. These are all dreams that you're hinging and expectations that you're hinging all of these emotions onto, and maybe it wouldn't have worked out that way. And so reconciling, what you do have control of right now, and how can you maintain or work to achieve pieces of that for yourself in the way that it looks today. So when you think about identity building and you think about even just maintaining identity, what are the different parts of you that make you you? Maybe you spend most of your time caregiving, but are you really into volunteering with animals? Or are you trying to go to graduate school and wanting to study for, the LSAT or whatever exam you need to take? Are you taking classes? Is there a way to not give up that? Or is there a way to maintain little pieces of it as you can, even if it doesn't get you where you want to be as quickly as possible, just to nurture those aspects of yourself? And then on top of it, in my opinion, I would say once you're deep in, are you able to reflect on ways that this is shaping your adulthood in a positive way? Are you able to look at some things that caregiving brings you and say, you know, I'm learning this right now, and I probably wouldn't have learned this lesson or this life experience without going through this right now. And this is enriching me in some way. So although it's unexpected and it doesn't align maybe with what you had thought would happen for you, is it taking you to a deeper place that maybe you wouldn't have chosen for yourself, but is actually meaningful?
Kind of off that idea, from the book, the way it's laid out, it really, for me reading it, it felt like it was describing this kind of wrenching process of caregiving and watching a loved one in this state. And there's moments like crying to the point of screaming, depression, anxiety, uncertainty. But despite all of this kind of this uncertainty and this kind of wrenching pain, I think there's something beautiful about it, because it only hurts that much because you love the person so deeply. And I want to get into, as you mentioned, identity and what it does to people's identity. But I also want to know how it feels for you when you hear people sharing their experiences and their journeys.
Sure. I think what you said is absolutely true, that, and which is why I highlight this in the book, is that there are these really difficult emotions that come about from caregiving. And there is this really beautiful response to it as well. And I don't think that we should only focus on one or the other, because sometimes caregiving is only talked about through silver linings and is only talked about in this very hallmarky way of oh, you're such a good person, and oh, you must mean so much to them. And or the flip of that, which is just the darkest parts of it being leaned into. And it really is both of these things, and to say it's only one or the other doesn't do the experience service. And so when I talk to people about their own experiences, it's, for me personally, it can be a bit difficult because I empathize with people so much. And the people in my book, I really came to know about their families and about them, you know, through the course of these interviews that we were doing. And so by the time I finished writing it, you know, I know how those family circumstances have changed over the course of the few years it took me to write that book. And so feeling like I know these families personally, you know, this can be quite difficult. But at the same time, I also am able to observe, sometimes maybe more than they can in the moment of living it, the wins that they're achieving and the way that particular people are growing throughout the process. I really can see that happen in real time. And I think a perfect example of this is two of the caregivers that I interview in the book. Both were living with parents that they were caregiving for. And they were pretty all hands on deck caregiving situations. And these were both caregivers who were working full-time jobs in specialized careers and then coming home to the person that they are caregiving for. And during the pandemic, we're doing both of those things under one roof with no break. And I could really see both of these people hit the point of burnout, recognize that they need to make a change, grapple with knowing that change needs to be, we have to live in separate spaces, feeling immense guilt for having this idea, over time, knowing it's the best thing, drawing that boundary, figuring out how to get it done, getting it done, feeling guilt after the fact, but knowing it's for the best, and frankly, improving their lives. Because they figured out how to make the situation better for themselves, even though it induced guilt, and they pulled it off. In the moment, watching them, knowing that they are finally doing something for themselves, really knowing how hard it is to make that decision, but seeing them do it, I can have this one step removed pride for them and excitement for them doing something for their own good. But also recognizing that at the time, they're not feeling that in that same way. And it was only after the fact, when they really lived the results of it, that they could see that they had done something really good for themselves. So I would say that I was definitely present and, having these, slightly digging conversations with people about, the difficulties around care and watching someone that you love have a debilitating disease. But at the same time, I could also really be present for some really positive ways in which they grew while they were caregiving.
Yeah, that's really cool that you could kind of see those positive moments, little bright spots that maybe would just go unnoticed if not. And it kind of reminds me in the book, you say that writing about how naming a feeling can make it easier to cope with. That feels similar and like kind of just taking a step and from that detached perspective, looking outside of yourself, outside of that very intense situation and kind of seeing some positives. What specific emotions do you think people struggle to articulate?
I think people struggle to articulate most of them for a variety of reasons. I think that often when we don't really consider our caregiving as a piece of ourselves and we're just living with it, it feels like this all-encompassing blanket over everything in our lives. It's kind of always at the back of our minds, no matter what we're doing. It just seeps in a lot of different ways. And if you don't take the time to separate out what is this emotion, why am I experiencing this, what is this feeling I have in my body related to this, then it continues to feel very, very powerful, like it has a power over you. But when you can sit and say, I am really angry today, and it's not just, oh, I'm so stressed, but I feel absolute anger. Why? And if you really isolate, I feel angry. A lot of caregivers can say, I'm so pissed off today, but often I think feel guilty saying that they're angry. That's something, and they feel guilty when somebody tries to make them feel better and it makes them even angrier. And then on top of it, don't really sit to think about why am I angry beyond I feel stressed and pushed to my max. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because for me, I realized that I was lashing out in anger at times. And really, it was just because I felt so out of control over what was going on with my dad's health, how to quote unquote save him. And it was real grief that I was feeling, but anger was the way that it manifested, and anger was the way that it came out. And so without taking the time to really pull apart these emotions, I think that any one of them that I list in the book could be difficult for a caregiver to name, which is exactly why I name them. Because could I have told you at the time that I felt isolated, that I felt lonely? I don't think so, because rationale in the moment would have said, I'm not. I have a lot of friends. I have a mom that's with me. My dad is still, of sound mind that I can talk to him about certain things. So I think when people then can look at the word isolated and see the way that other caregivers are experiencing isolation, even there are caregivers that I interview in the book. These two guys both told me that well, I know they're both single men. They are both caregiving for a parent. And they both told me that they didn't know any other single guys their age, which is mid 30s to early 40s, that were caregivers, unless it was as a secondary to a spouse who was caregiving for their own parent. And so they both felt completely isolated and alone, not knowing any other guys their age that were doing this. While I'm interviewing them and I'm hearing each one of them say this, I knew that they knew each other. They knew each other through my group, and I know that. And when I would say to one of them, well, how about this guy? They were like, oh yeah, he's a cool guy. But it was this internalized isolation that really prevents people at times from seeing the people that are around them and that they could reach out to. Without naming that isolation and looking for a way to break it, you may not be even aware of the ways in which your perceived isolation is compounding on top of itself. So I'd say a lot of these emotions were difficult for people to put names to, including for myself.
Yeah, what do you think are like the smallest steps people could do to kind of begin to break those habits of those internalized feelings?
I'd say, first of all, identify as a caregiver. And that seems completely obvious, but I didn't identify as a caregiver when I was doing it. I think becoming aware of the role and becoming aware of the fact that a caregiver doesn't mean necessarily that you are living with the person providing their care 24/7. I was living in LA, my dad was in New York, and I was his caregiver. I was dealing with his logistics from a distance. I was traveling back and forth to be with him. I was his medical proxy. I was involved in everything that was going on. You can be a long distance caregiver and still be a caregiver. You can not have to be the primary caregiver to still be a caregiver. You know, just taking the guilt, I think, away from applying this term to yourself actually reduces feelings of isolation in people, because you then realize, well, you're part of a larger community of people, of this role, of people that have taken on this responsibility. This isn't, as I mentioned before, this all-encompassing experience that you don't know how to name all of the different things. And so it takes on this power outside of you. So once you identify as a caregiver, you can then Google caregiving resources near me. You can look for support groups. You can look for support groups tailored to like PSP or tailored to people in your area or tailored to people of your own age. Whatever those qualifying identifiers that feel important to you are, you can look for that. So I would say the first step is identifying and then reaching out and not being so strict about the resources that you're looking for. There's one caregiver that I interview in the book. She said that she's, you know, raising her two kids while caregiving for her spouse. And she's found a lot of support through a group for single parents. She's not a single parent. Her husband lives at home, but a lot of the things that she deals with emotionally and logistically are similar to those of single parents. And so, you know, what are ways that you can rethink your situation to find the support that you need and not be so picky about it?
Wow. Yeah, I really like that. I really like that because, like, for, I mean, cure PSP community, especially, they're obviously rare diseases. And just in thinking of for my own role as like a marketing specialist and like trying to promote these diseases, raise more awareness, like we have a massive caregiving community, and I feel like they can relate more sometimes to like, yeah, just other caregivers and other people struggling with whatever issue it is. And I really like how you're kind of, encouraging people to go connect with other types of communities because, yeah, it will just show that these are a lot more common than we think.
Absolutely. And I have to say too that I have a bunch of people in Caregiver Collective who have joined who are dealing with family members with PSP. But also, there are people that join the group who will introduce themselves and what they're dealing with in their family. And I think that sounds like PSP. Like, are they dealing with this and they don't realize that they are? And obviously, I can't diagnose anybody. But I do think that when you're in a group that's a broad group, there are things to be learned even about specific diseases like PSP that maybe you wouldn't have known to look for.
I also want to talk about, in addition to the caregiving relationship you have with your loved one, also just how do these illnesses, how do they change entire family dynamics and everyone's identities? Because it's just so common. I feel like when one of these diagnoses happens, you really don't know how your family and those people close to you are going to react. Why do you think it's so just random and unexpected even?
I don't think it's random, and I'm not sure that you could say it's unexpected because the people that I've interviewed around their changed family dynamics, I would say from what they described, it sounds like if anything, disease revealed who that person already was in their family. And in my case, unexpected silver lining, my parents got closer. That I would say was unexpected. That was lovely and interesting, and I really has changed the way that I think about family and marriage. But when I talk to people about things like sibling dynamics, it is statistically probable that only one sibling is going to take on the majority of caregiving, even if they don't want to. I mean, even if they don't necessarily see it coming or think it's reasonable, which most people don't, that the first caregiver I ever met who was my age, we met over the phone. We had been introduced and we are the same age. I was an only child. I wanted siblings so badly as an adult. And then I speak with this caregiver, Leah, who's one of seven adult children, and she is the only person to take on care of her parents. And she said that the reasons her siblings had not to be involved ran the gamut, that sometimes it was the relationship they had with their parents. Often it was excuses of why they couldn't be there that she believed was born out of denial for her parents' debilitating diseases. And I really see this in a lot of the people that I've interviewed. It is not necessarily across gender lines. I know we expect in our society and in a lot of cultural backgrounds that it's the woman who takes on care if there's brothers and sibling and sisters involved. And that has definitely been the case in some of the people that I've interviewed, that they were seen as the natural person to take on care. But it hasn't always been that way. I've interviewed a guy who's one of three brothers, and for whatever reason, he's the one to take on care. And he wants his brother's help so badly, and they refuse to give it to him in one way or another. There are also instances when there is a brother and a sister, and the parent wants the brother because they're the older child. And so they naturally lean on them. And the sister is trying to be involved and is fighting a little bit for some agency in the caregiving. So there are a lot of different ways that this can shake out. But when you look at it statistically, it's most likely going to be one sibling. Although there are great cases I've seen in which there are multiple siblings that have figured out a way to work with each other, whether it felt natural or not. So there's that. And there's also people I've interviewed who have found that their spouses are not aligned in caregiving in the ways that they would hope they would be, whether that's on deciding whether to move a parent in with them and they're on different pages about that. Or whether it's a parent does live with them or anyone that they're caregiving for, frankly, and that spouse just refuses to be involved for whatever reason, or is emotionally supportive but logistically does not help. There's a lot of ways in which this can shake out. And from what I have seen, it seems like there were hints that it could go this way before it happened.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, that fact about like it's statistically likely for just one sibling to do most of the responsibilities. Do you see that changing? Do you think it's always been that way?
I would say, just off the cuff, to take a guess, I think it's always been this way. Just because when I look at groups of caregivers who are older, it seems to be the same in older demographics as well. And I think that when, like right now in this generation, we're almost split evenly, men and women who take on caregiving. And that's new. That has not been the case in previous generations. But even still, in these male dynamics, it's one person often taking on the care, even when it's the guy. So it just seems like it always has to do with family dynamics and what that looks like. But also, there are sometimes when people take on care and they don't want anybody's help because they don't want to have to make decisions with somebody else, even when other people want to be involved. So just to speak completely speculatively, I think that this is something that's always most likely happened, although hopefully it begins to change. as you know, therapy is more common now. So,
That's true.
hopefully, people can figure out ways to work together.
You have a fact in the book, a stat. There's 600 billion in unpaid labor from caregiving, and that is just like such a staggering fact to me that just kind of shows the very like real reality of this like crisis and just how many people go through this and are a part of this. Could you describe like what's included in that figure in the 600 billion? What labor goes into that?
Sure. That's family caregiving. So I'll talk a little bit about why I believe we're in this crisis that has led to so much family caregiving, right? Because we are taking on care in our generation at a younger age in larger numbers than ever before. That was really when I saw that statistic. I thought, why? What's going on? That we can't just accept this as a fact. We need to understand why this is happening. And so when you look at the way people are aging nowadays, we are living longer and longer with chronic disease and longer with chronic disease at home than ever before. And that's due to medical advancements, right? I mean, even look within the PSP community about clinical trials and ways that we are able to extend longevity even with a serious disease. And often, that is done in the family's home. If you haven't elected to move your family member into a nursing home, or even if you have, there's still a level of family caregiving that's involved. So when you are no longer recuperating for long periods of time in the hospital and that care is being shifted to the home, the hospital system has created this system called hospital to home for the last couple of decades that allows people to receive certain treatments at home, whether that's, infusion therapy, physical therapy, no matter what that looks like. But once that person transitions home and you have this acute period in which care may be provided by Medicaid that's, related to a hospitalization or a rehab, really the care stops. So, what are the options at that point? You already have long-term care insurance, which I hear mixed reviews about whether that really does help in the event of hiring home care. You have Medicaid, if you're eligible, in which you could get a private nurse's aide for a certain amount of time a week or a day program or whatever that looks like. But it leaves gaps. Our lack of long-term care insurance policies in our country, the amount of people that are living at home with chronic disease or different ailments or handicaps and need care, and the amount of programs that are available to us and private aids that are available to us in a time in which we have a major private healthcare aid shortage in our country, because that is a devalued profession financially and at times culturally, it leaves this massive gap in care in which the family is left to step in and to provide it, because otherwise, who else will? And so that's how you get to this staggering statistic of what that translates to in dollars and cents, because most often the family member is not being paid for that work. They are doing what a professional would provide, often without adequate training, and often in addition to full-time or part-time jobs, whatever they're able to continue managing as they're taking on care, that also translates to a part-time or full-time job. So it leads to a situation that's really unmanageable in the present and untenable for the future.
Millennials, because you're typically earlier in your profession, you mentioned that it's hard to have these conversations with your employer. Is there ways that we can make caregiving more visible to employers who just so caregivers can get just more comfort and just more, support?
Absolutely. As far as the corporate level, what I write about in my book is cultivating a culture of care awareness, which really needs to be done from within the corporation. But if it doesn't already exist, or small business, let's say, if it doesn't already exist, then how can a caregiver who's in need of these supports advocate for themselves in a way that they feel doesn't jeopardize their standing at the office, because there is often caregiver discrimination or bias, implicit or explicit, that people are afraid to speak up about their home situation at work because of it. So is there a way to connect with colleagues who are also caregivers in which you can approach your employer as a group, safety in numbers? Is there a way for you to reach out to a caregiving advocacy organization and ask them for tips on how to approach your employer? There was a girl in my group who was in her early 20s. I write about her in the book, actually, whose dad had a stroke. And that was obviously not an event that was planned for. He was in the hospital for weeks to months, and she had to be there with him. She said that her employer first allowed her to take that time off, and after a certain point made it very clear that if she continued to, she would lose her job. She was 23. This was her first job. It was a very small office in which she was not covered by the Family Medical Leave Act, FMLA, which requires a minimum of 50 employees in order to get protected unpaid leave. So she was terrified because she thought, I have to be here with my dad, but at the same time, I can't lose my job. And so I matched her with an organization that existed at the time that advocated for paid family leave. And they were armed with how to reach out to employers to show that if you offer some sort of paid family leave, this actually benefits you in the long run. And they've been successful at winning this at major corporations. And when you can approach a business, even a small business, and say, here's how we can scale that for you, and here's why you'll win by offering this to your employees. And this will make you a really attractive company to come work for, because caregiving in our generation is a broader issue than is given attention to, then, you know, you have some hope in moving the needle. And I would say that for an individual who's trying to do this for themselves at work, understanding what would help you the most? Is it time of leave that you need to be away from the office? Is it a flexible or remote work schedule? You know, what would make this work for you? There was one caregiver in my group who felt very stalled at her job. She was caregiving for both parents, long distance, and she really just wanted more professional growth. Even though she was happy at her company, she didn't see herself growing there. And so she got a job at another company in which they offered her a promotion, more money. But when she was there, they realized that she was not given as much flexibility in her hours in which she could call doctors on her parents' behalf, call insurance companies, all of the things that fell on her plate as a caregiver that she needed to balance with her career. And because she wasn't given that flexibility there, she actually left that job and went back to her previous employer. So, you know, these considerations and these concessions from an employer can really help retain talent at a company by offering different things. And so absolutely, at the corporate level, I think is a great place to start in cultivating this what's called culture of care awareness and offering these programs, even if it's a support group for caregivers at work, helping them out with resources, things that don't even cost the company money, but acknowledge who is in their workforce, show them respect, and at the same time, show that these whatever benefits are being offered are being utilized by people at the top, and a top-down approach so that people don't feel a stigma in using the benefits that are offered to them.
Yeah. Are there any direct places people could learn more about this like culture of care awareness? I think that I really like that phrase.
My book. I have a section in my book that's about this. The research that I cite is from the AARP policy. I think it off the top of my head, I think it's the Policy Institute. They have an entire handbook on what employers can do. And they talk about cultivating this culture of care awareness. And that's available online for free.
What these trends you described of, you know, an aging population, people living longer now with modern medicine, like, does it seem like this is going to continue? Like, it seems like from what you said, these caregiving populations, like younger caregiving populations, are only going to get bigger.
This issue in my and I think probably most people's estimations is not only going to continue, it's going to get worse. Because when we look at birth rates in our country and we see that people are having fewer children or no children, well, what does that translate to when it comes to family caregiving down the line? Who's going to be available, frankly, to step in and provide this care? So I don't think there's only an issue in it becoming more of an exacerbated topic and crisis, but also really warrants us looking at family caregiving and saying, what do we want this to look like for our society? Is it right that we're putting so much medical and emotional responsibility on family who are also trying to be part of the workforce, who are also trying to raise children, be good neighbors, build communities? Is it right that all of this gets put onto people, often unsuspecting? Or should we maybe look at our infrastructure and rebuild it in a way that provides the care that we really need at a professional level? So that can family be involved, and should they? In my opinion, absolutely, if that's what the family dynamic lends itself to. If you want to be a family caregiver full-time, is that available to you? Absolutely. But it shouldn't feel like something that people are backed into without choice is often the feeling that gets communicated. People say, I feel like I didn't have a choice. And would they have wanted to take on some level of family care? Yes. But just not all of it in the way that was really felt to be deemed necessary.
No, yeah, that is such a big topic. And pretty much all Americans have some issues with our healthcare system. And for rare diseases, especially, like, it's just so not equipped for handling them. And we're slowly starting to get them, like, the palliative care movement is growing. And I think that's really crucial, like making it more of like an interactive experience between those living with it, the caregivers, and then the physicians and doctors, like getting their input and adjusting based on it for diseases like this, where there's no therapeutics or anything. We're pretty much just trying to manage symptoms. So I don't really have anything to say about it, but it is like, if there were ways that we could slowly start moving the needle to making it just more interactive, then yeah.
And this kind of in line with what you're talking about, a holistic approach, right? Where it's not just treating it in a doctor's office, treating it, you know, in a behavioral therapist's office, and all of these things, treating it with an insurance company, and all of these things are seen as independent pieces and none of them work together. But instead, they clearly all do work together. You need to have all of these things in play. You need to have family, you need to have doctors, you need to have, you know, handicap accessible resources in your area. You need all of these things happening together, right? But we don't have this widespread system in which they are all treated dependently and codependently on each other. It's all, you know, so piecemeal. And so how can we move towards what you're talking about, where like this notion of palliative care or a care case manager, you know, where somebody has their eye on the whole big picture and can see how all of those pieces are working together.
So you obviously talked to numerous people, numerous care partners to write this book. What did you learn from about people and about the ways that we care for people and what we care about? Like, what has this whole experience taught you?
It's taught me a lot. The thing that jumped out at me the most is often when people would say, I didn't have a choice. I took this on and I didn't have a choice. And my instinct is to tell them, you did. You felt like you didn't have a choice because you love your family member or your friend, whomever you're taking care of. And so it felt like there's a fire and someone needs to help put it out. And so you jumped in. But not everybody makes that choice. There are people that jump ship and that's the choice they make. So in so many people electing to help care for someone in their family or in their community, because not everyone is biologically or legally related that's a caregiver. There are people I interview who are caregiving for friends of theirs. It really shows you the connectivity amongst all of us. It really shows you that when push comes to shove, as much as we are a capitalist society that prizes achievement and prizes bank accounts and material possessions and all of the things that are sold to us in commercials, when it push comes to shove, people are choosing the quote unquote like less sexy option and the thing that has heart at its very core and that is often unacknowledged and underappreciated by people outside of their own family or misunderstood most of the time. And people are choosing, in my estimation, to do it because of their values, because of they believe, because of who the people are in their lives and what they mean to them and what humanity means to them, you know, what it is to be human and to see people at their most vulnerable and to be there for those moments. I mean, it opens you up to an entirely different life experience than you could get by going to work every day and only being amongst colleagues or only being amongst friends. All of these things are important, but it adds a new layer to life and understanding that is invaluable. And everyone that I've spoken to carries a piece of that with them, that they may be immediately talking about the most stressful thing because that's what they dealt with today, or they may be in the midst of caregiver burnout and really can't see past it for a time. But there are always these threads that are pulling them back to the person that they care for. And I think that's why often you hear the word guilt expressed so much. I feel so guilty taking time for myself. I feel so guilty talking about how difficult this is because people are often positioning the person they care for above themselves. And it's very selfless. And there are some boundaries that we need to place on it in order to remain healthy. But at the same time, that notion that it's an instinct inside all of us to put someone ahead of ourselves is a really beautiful thing.
When you were caregiving for your dad, what gestures from other people, does anything stick out as making a difference for you that other people might have done for you?
Absolutely. There are a lot of moments that were from strangers who could recognize that I was struggling with a wheelchair in the street. I mean, I feel like whenever I say this, I get met with a blank stare, but wheelchairs are really difficult to navigate. They look super easy. And I was having consistently the hardest time. It was heavy. Trying to get it over a curb was really difficult. If some parked at the part of the curb that's for handicap accessibility, you know, sorry, that's a nice parking spot for you, but I don't know how to get my dad on the sidewalk now because you put your car there. Thank you for that. So there are moments when I saw complete selfishness in that way, but more often that someone saw me struggling and jumped over to help me. And in turn, I now realize how difficult it is to maneuver with somebody that needs physical help, whether it's a wheelchair or, you know, holding doors open for a walker. You can do it and you should try. You should get out there. But at the same time, you know, when you're used to just ably walking down the street very easily, you're not really considering often how difficult that same action is for somebody else and how much extra energy it takes. And so because I've, you know, had these kind of difficult moments just with accessibility, now when I see somebody else going through it, even if it doesn't look like they're struggling, but if somebody's walking with a cane and they're approaching a door, I'll grab the door because I know it's just easier to have somebody hold the door open for you. So I think the more that we're aware of it in our own lives, we can start to see it out in the world and, you know, just help each other out in small little ways. And I take that from the ways and the small ways in which I was helped out.
For the Cure PSP community, your book, you're talking to caregivers of multiple diseases, is that correct?
It's all sorts of situations.
Yeah, so all sorts of situations. Yeah.
Dealing with mental illness and dementia, chronic diseases, medical emergencies like a stroke, various things.
Yeah, so how does caring for someone with a rare disease, how would that be even more complicated than the average caregiving experience?
I think in my experience, it was complicated because you are looking for resources, especially when I was caregiving for my dad. You know, this was over 10 years ago. And so even the Cure PSP community was smaller then. And when you're looking for resources to point you in the right direction for support, for clinical trials, just for information, when you're dealing with a rare disease, obviously they can be more difficult to find. The helpful thing with PSP was that it was kind of one-stop shop with Cure PSP. And even then the organization offered quite a lot. But I think you're really looking for ways to help yourself and ways to help the person you care for. I would say in priority, inverse order. You're looking for ways to help the person you care for and in turn some resources for yourself. And when it comes to a rare disease, often I was dealing with information that wasn't medically proven yet. So I would read things in the Cure PSP message board about different things that had not been necessarily proven in clinical trials, but that some families had found did work in prolonging a person's life or longevity. And then when I would read about it and then ask my dad's doctor about it, they would say, well, we have heard there has been some success with this, but I can't recommend that to you because it is not proven in a trial. So just learning about these things and thinking, well, there's no harm in trying and we're going to do it. You know, let's try everything we can. When it's a rare disease, some of that information can be harder to come by. It's also difficult to meet other people that are dealing with the disease and what it looks like. The Cure PSP message board was helpful for me because people would talk about the various stages and what the disease progression looked like. And so that helped me to get an understanding of what to expect. But at the same time, I went to one conference with other PSP families after my dad had passed away. And I realized that there were people who were diagnosed with PSP that had completely different experiences than what my family had lived. And that made me think, actually, is PSP so, are we just at the very iceberg tip of understanding PSP? Is this something that is actually more of an umbrella disease? And the way my dad had it is a totally different strand, to say, than what this other family is dealing with. And so 20 years from now, are we going to be able to look back at this and we'll have those answers? But right now we're calling all of it PSP. I don't know. You know, it's when you're dealing with a rare disease, it's you don't know what you don't know. And so you're trying to take information where you can.
Yeah, and that almost just sounds like another reason why you should like look for, you know, support groups and just ways for advice and whatnot. You know, if you have a specific issue that is obviously like more pressing than, you know, the average PSP, like, I don't know if there even is. Yeah, as you, because there is, you're so right. There's like a wide range of outcomes, and some people can seem to be living a lot longer than others with this.
Yeah, because like my dad had it for like this, in retrospect, brief stint, at least in the way that it was displayed, that we could really tell there was something going on. And then I met someone who was my age and her dad had PSP and he had it for decades and it really altered his personality. And he was doing things that were like really outside the box of what was expected. And they attributed that to PSP. We had nothing like that with my dad. And so, right, the more that you talk to people, the more you can learn about it. And I think also figure out ways to communicate to people who don't know about it, what it is. Often when people ask me what PSP is, I say it's a neurodegenerative disease that is considered Parkinsonian, but displayed more like ALS. And, you know, try to relate it to what people do know. But, you know, this language becomes easier to come by talking to other people who are also trying to communicate a similar thing.
You describe millennials as a very family-oriented generation. How do you see care changing in the future from this generation that seems to place such a importance on family?
I think it begins with us sharing out loud and audibly that we do place such a high priority on family. Because at least when I was starting in my career, you didn't admit anything at home that was going on. I mean, I had friends that didn't even tell people at work that they were pregnant, you know, during like a hiatus from the job, because they didn't want people to know that they were going to be a parent when they came back to the office, because having any priority outside of work was seen as a detriment. We're already seeing that shift, right? We've seen it shift even more since the pandemic, that people, particularly millennials, have decided that a work-life balance is more important than chronic burnout for a career in an economy that's completely unstable. That doesn't mean that our career is not important to us, but acknowledging that our family at home is important to us is new-ish. And, you know, actually advocating for that those rights at work is something that we are seeing grow more and more. And this isn't just in achieving a quote unquote work-life balance. This is also in what we're seeing as far as multi-generational households and how that's changing in the millennial generation. So I think just as we not only live it by showing love to our families the way that our parents have and their parents have, but the more that we say it's a priority and the more that we make our choices based on that, this will start to shift, hopefully, how our policies are created, how we're viewed at work, how many supports are, you know, fought for and provided, whether it's through your corporation, whether it's through the state, whether it's through our federal system. And as we live these priorities vocally, then hopefully the world we're living in will catch up to match that.
And if someone listening is struggling right now, what would you want them to remember?
Struggling with caregiving, you mean?
Like, yeah. Someone listening is a caregiver and struggling. What would you want them to know?
That they are definitely not alone in this experience. Every day, there is somebody that joins my group, at least one person, who says, I don't know anybody else that's going through this. I feel so alone. I feel completely overwhelmed. I'm now reading stories of other people in this group and already starting to feel better. Just knowing that you are not the only person shouldering all of this, that there are other people who can hear you and understand what you're going through, maybe even have advice for you, can model your experience back to you so that you don't feel like such an outlier. All of this doesn't change what you're dealing with day to day, but it changes how you perceive yourself. You start to recognize you are part of a community. You are part of a larger movement that's going on in our country. And that alone can remove some of those feelings of isolation and make you feel just a little bit better.
Thanks so much to Jennifer for sharing her story and the incredible work she's doing through Caregiver Collective and her new book, Generation Care. There's some really fresh and practical ideas in the book, and overall it's a nice reminder that you are never truly alone. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can find a link to Generation Care in our episode description. I'm your host, Oscar Sullivan. Talk to you again soon.